All welcome to Church of the King. We are stepping back into part two of the Abrahamic Covenant. We have been discussing so far, we've discussed the Edenic Covenant, the Adamic Covenant, and the Noah Covenant. And we started last week on the Abrahamic Covenant. We did part two because I dealt with the Melchizedek idea of not necessarily being a theophany, but it being an actual person who was there. And so we discussed that using scripture, going back and forth, cross-referencing. If you were not able to hear that, it is, of course, available on our website. And you just go and find sermons on the page, and you can get right there. So we looked at Genesis chapter 12 last week. And remember, we looked at the call. Abraham was just called. That he was called out from among his people, called out from his nation, called out from his land, from his family. We established that God called Abraham, who was an idol worshiper, to himself and to follow his voice. That Abraham was from Ur of the Chaldeans, right? That these were people who were not necessarily following who God was. There's a record of his genealogy, but not much is really said about who Abram was, who his father was, and what their connection was, other than that Joshua, if you remember, looking back at Joshua, it says that they were idol worshipers, right? Joshua 24, I think, was the chapter that we looked at. And so that was the call. So when we first encounter Abraham, who is at this point still Abram, right? In Genesis, we know him as Father Abraham. Read about him in the New Testament as Father Abraham, but the reality is he is still Abram at this point. Genesis chapter 12, verses 1 to 3, just to reread those. Now the Lord said to Abram, go forth from your country, from your relatives, from your father's house to the land, which I will show you. And I will make you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great, and so you shall be a blessing. And I will bless those who bless you, and the ones who curse you, I will curse. And in you, all the families of the earth will be blessed. And in verse 4, my favorite part is, so Abraham went forth. Abraham went. He did. He just stepped out in faith and went after him. And so what I want us to see here and point out is that we see grace and mercy and love at work from God in this moment. Because God in this moment is stretching himself out of the darkened understanding of humanity, of who he is. God is stretching himself out into the understanding of a pagan mindset that worships, sorry, many gods. It's more a polytheistic worship, not a monotheistic. And so he is stretching himself into humanity's darkened understanding. He stretches himself into a family, a pagan family, and he calls out Abraham for himself. So even before the covenant has been formally enacted, God's grace is at work to redeem a people that he has chosen. Abram is promised a good land. He's promised a great nation. He's promised a great name and a great blessing and a seed, right? Whoops, sorry, somebody's. That will extend first to him, then in verse 2, to all the families of the earth, and then, or verse 3, then to all the families of the earth. And so we understand that that seed, according to Galatians, that blessing, it's not all the children of Israel, it's the seed which speaks to Jesus. And we will talk more about that when we go back, because after we study all these covenants as they are, we will go back to them through the lens of Jesus, how Jesus fulfills them, and really begin to see how he operates through these covenants, how God was revealing his love, how God was revealing his intention from the beginning, how it's been a continual journey of God with humanity to unveil who he is to the darkened mindsets and understandings of man since they disconnected from God in the fall in the Garden of Eden. Because in reality, when we were separated from God, the fall was just this separation, not that we actually were, but we thought we were. We ate of the tree of knowing, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. In God's view, we were never separated. In our view, we were, because now we took on a knowledge that was not really for us to take on. We didn't have to. And so when we disconnect from the tree of life. Anytime, that's why when they ate of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, God said, if you do, in dying you will die. Meaning that they began to perish. Their thinking, their understanding, their mindset, their understanding of the relationship, the understanding of who God was began to perish. Why? Because anytime that you disconnect from a life source, there's only one source of all life. And that's God. That's the tree of life. So that's Him. So when we disconnected through this tree of knowledge, what we did was cut ourselves off from the source. And anytime we eat from that tree, we are partaking of what is not in life itself. And so here we are now in this Abrahamic covenant where God is taking His plan of redemption a step further. His journey with man a little further, and their understanding of God a little more brightly understood, more discernible as He begins to share who He is more and more. And right now He's doing this through Abram. So just in verse 6, I'm sorry, I left off. Now, when we pick up in Genesis 15, So now we pick up in Genesis 15. I'm sorry. So after these things, this is after, meaning that after Abram had helped set Lot free, had had his encounter with the king Melchizedek, it says, after these things, the word of the Lord came to Abraham. This is Genesis 15, verse 1, in a vision, saying, do not fear, Abram. I am a shield to you. Your reward shall be very great. And Abram said, O Lord God, what will you give me since I am childless? And the heir of my house is Eliezer, or of Damascus. And Abram said, since you have given no offspring to me, one born in my house, in my heir, then behold, the word of the Lord came to him saying, this man will not be your heir, but one who will come forth from your own body, he shall be your heir. And he took him outside and said, now look toward the heavens and count the stars. If you are able to count them, and he said to them, so shall your descendants be. Then he, meaning Abram, believed in the Lord, and he reckoned it to him. He believed in the Lord, and then he, God, reckoned it to him as righteousness. And he said to him, I am the Lord who brought you out of Ur of the Chaldeans to give you this land to possess it. He said, O Lord God, how may I know that I will possess it? And so God says, he said to him, bring me a three-year-old heifer, a three-year-old female goat, and a three-year-old ram, and a turtle dove, and a young pigeon. Then he brought all of these to him. He cut them in two, laid them each half opposite the other, but he did not cut the bird. So imagine this. He has a heifer. He has a goat. He has a ram that he has cut in half and has placed them across from one another. So this is a pretty gruesome scene, right? There's a lot of blood in a heifer. There's a lot of blood in a goat. And then the two doves, they're not cut. They're set across from one another. And so then he brought all these to him. Now verse 11, the birds of prey came down upon the carcasses and Abram drove them away. So Abram had done this at some point and was waiting on God. So these birds of prey, probably vultures or something like that, they're swooping in because the flesh is available. And I was reading somewhere, it says it takes about 6 to 12 hours for something to die that the vultures and all begin to sense it and fly in to smell it. So this was something that may have happened early in the day, and Abram is being vigilant over and keeping them away from the carcasses, because this is about a covenant that God has called him to. Abram would have known what God was asking him. This was called the covenant of pieces in that day. And it was one of the ways that they made covenants in the ancient Near East. This was a normal thing, a normal practice in that day. Don't think that this was a one-time thing God did one time with Abram and it never happened again. This was a practice of that day, of that region, in a way that they would cut covenant with one another. And that becomes important a little bit later as I share more after we read this passage. So verse 12, now when the sun was going down, a deep sleep fell upon Abram, and behold, terror and great darkness fell upon him. God said to Abram, know for certain that your descendants will be strangers in a land that is not theirs, where they will be enslaved and oppressed 400 years. But I will also judge the nation whom they will serve, and afterward they will come out with many possessions. As for you, you shall go to your fathers in peace. You will be buried at a good old age. But then in the fourth generation, they will return here, for the iniquity of the Amorite is not yet complete. Verse 17, it came about when the sun had set that it was very dark, and behold, there appeared a smoking oven and a flaming torch which passed between these pieces. And on that day the Lord made a covenant with Abram, saying, to your descendants I have given this land, from the river of Egypt as far as the great river, the river Euphrates, the Kenite and the Kenzite and the Kadmonite, the Hittite and the Perizzite and the Rephaim, the Amorite and the Canaanite and the Girgashite and the Jebusite. That's the end of chapter 15. And so if you look back here, you look at verse, says to Abraham, I will provide, right? If you look at it, it says he will provide a son, and Abraham believed. If you look at back at verse 4 through 6, the word of the Lord came to him saying, this man will not be your son, right? He's saying, I will provide you a son. He says in verse 1, I am your shield, your reward. Abram says, begins to discuss this fact that he's still childless. He still doesn't have an heir, since you've given me no offspring. And the Lord came to him saying, this man will not be your heir, but one who will come forth from your own body. He shall be your heir. And he says to him that your descendants, it's not even just the one son. You're looking at the one son. God is saying, there is an inheritance of you, of descendants, that is more numerous than the stars. That is more numerous than the stars. There's another place that talks about the sand, that there would be more numerous that he can't even count the sands. And so God's grace here, God is telling him, I am going to give you a son. So then it says, then he believed God. He reckoned it to him as righteousness. In verse 6. And so Abram, in verse 6, he believed the Lord, and God reckoned it to him as righteousness. But by verse 8, Abram wonders again, how is this possible? And asks God, but how will I know? How will I know? Meaning, how will I know you're going to keep your word? So even though Abraham is considered the father of our faith and one who is counted righteous because of his faith, it wasn't perfect faith. It wasn't that he didn't doubt. It wasn't that he didn't have human struggles, because that's the reality. The process, the struggle in our humanity to comprehend this God as he puts himself forth, not the God we make in our image, but the God that shows himself as is sometimes hard for us. And it takes time. It takes faith building. We have to build that muscle of belief and faith and allow God to be faithful and true to what he says. But it's interesting, because we rebuke people for a lack of faith sometimes, but isn't it interesting that God doesn't rebuke Abram? Instead, he's not judging this lack of faith, but he wants to move Abram beyond that lack of faith. And so what God does is, instead of rebuking him or saying something harsh or how can you doubt me or reminding him of the word, instead, God takes this extra step toward Abram and gets him to gather these animals and to make this covenant of pieces as a way to move him beyond his unbelief to believe me, because I am about to make covenant with you. Before that, it was just promises. It says that Abram built an altar, which means he worshiped there. Doesn't say he made sacrifices. He may have. It just says he built an altar. Says later he called upon his name. And so we see here God calling, let's say it that way, Abram beyond his unbelief. God just jumps right in and says, get for me a three-year-old heifer. Get for me a female goat, three-year-old lamb, and these two doves. And then he brought all those to God, and he cut them in half. This is an especially powerful moment, because this is where God is taking on something that is humanity's for the sake of humanity. These covenants were already being done by the Hittites. They were already being done by other cultures. So God makes this covenant with Abram as a way of showing him, I am meeting you where you are. I am meeting you where you are at. It's a powerful moment, because in ancient Near East, this was, as I said, a common practice between two parties. They would cut the animals in half, lay them across from one another, and the two parties would pass between the pieces. And this was a symbolic gesture that each party was pledging their lives to keep their word. It's like saying, as they're walking through these animals, may it be done unto me like what has been done to these animals if I break my word. So this was an amazing act that we miss because we don't understand the history around this moment. Abram knew this practice. He understood what this meant. And he was willing to make this covenant with God. And he waited for the Lord to come. But then what happens? A burning furnace or a smoking oven. It had been a small bread oven that would have been like cylinder. And they would have buried them in the ground to bake bread and that kind of thing. So there is this smoking oven, this burning oven, with smoke coming from it. And then there is a torch. They show up. These two things show up. Now, I believe based on the text and based on what is actually recorded here, this is God making the covenant with himself. Because if you go back to this passage, it says that, should have highlighted that. But if you go back to the passage where it says that on your, okay, verse 17, it came about when the sun had set, that it was very dark, and behold, there appeared a smoking oven and a flaming torch which passed between the pieces. Abram did not pass through those pieces. The smoking oven and the flaming torch passed through those pieces. That's important for us to comprehend. And so what we have to understand here is that God was pledging himself to and binding himself to this word. I believe that those are manifestations of God, the furnace and the torch. And I also believe that they speak to a promise that I'll get to in a few minutes. Just kind of keep your thumb there in your mind about coming back to this. See, this was God revealing to Abram, just as we stated earlier, God would provide. Abram just needed to believe. Just believe. So it was God pledging himself to and binding himself through a vow to see what Abram, to see that Abram's promises would come about. All Abram had to do was believe that they would come about. It wasn't up to Abram. God himself was saying, I'm going to see this covenant through. And through this act, God himself, through the walking through, the passing through of the furnace and the torch, it is God himself saying, I pledge my own life to the keeping of this promise. I pledge myself to this word. I am pledging my own life to this promise to you, Abram. He didn't demand Abram walk through that. The torch and the oven pass through those pieces. God was pledging himself to Abram and the fulfillment of that promise that he made then, but also that he made way back with Eve. When he said that your seed will crush the head of the enemy. God pledged himself. God made an oath to himself and just made Abram a partaker of all of the blessings that were there. He made the vow, the oath. He took that vow and he took that oath. Through this pledge, through this act of love, God himself was willing to suffer and to die in order to follow through with his love for Abram. That's what it meant. If I as a person and Greg as a person had made this covenant and we walked through those pieces, what we were saying is, I am willing to die to keep this promise. Interesting. God himself walks through and he's pledging that he himself will die to keep this promise. Guess who dies 2,000 years ago on a cross? God himself, to see this promise come about. We've got more prophetic pictures here for us to take a glimpse at, to see how committed, how loving God has always been and how willing he was go to bring us into redemption from the very beginning. Not just 7,000 or 10,000 years later, it had always been his plan, always was his desire. Saying to Abraham, I am a God who keeps his covenant, and I will keep this covenant at any cost and all cost to myself. This is my oath. This is my vow. This is my word to you, but also to all humanity. As I pass through these parts, representing the smoke and representing the fire, I make this pledge to you that I am willing to do anything to see this promise come about. We see several things here. Again, we see God setting himself apart from other gods. We see this because this is one of the things that we've been seeing through the Edenic covenant, through the Adamic covenant, and then through the Noah covenant. But now we see this also in the Abrahamic covenant. We see how willing and how able and how far God is willing to set himself ahead of what these others are worshiping around them to create a monotheistic people who will worship the God of Israel, the one true God. So, as we looked back a few weeks ago, if you remember, we discussed three kinds of covenants: the grant covenant, the kinship covenant, and the vassal covenant. And it's interesting to note how these covenants were conducted. So again, when this was happening between God and Abram, this wasn't a God idea that gets brought to the earth. This is a man idea that God chooses to become a part of. And isn't that exactly what he did with Jesus? It's amazing to see how many ways God just jumps in to our broken humanity and our misunderstandings to say, hey, here I am. This is what I'm really like. Come see me. Come be with me. Let me love you because that's my only intent. So here God jumps into these ancient, dark covenants. Not his, but the way that they made them. They called them treatises, but they were covenants. So, throughout the ancient Near East, these treaties were very similar. They were, of course, some intercultural differences, meaning the ancient Near East, and there would be some local variations based on the people, based on their customs, based on the gods they worshipped, based on the kind of temples and that kind of thing that they had. So there would be some variations, but for the most part, they were conducted the same way, especially in content and order of elements. This will be more clear when we study the Mosaic covenant, because you'll see how Deuteronomy really lays out step by step the way that these covenants or these treatises would have worked. But I don't want to inject that yet. And so the most famous ancient Near East treaties or covenants come from the Hittites of the early to mid second millennium BC. And the Neo-Assyrians, whose kingdom flourished from about the early 9th to the late 7th centuries BC. The Neo-Assyrian kings also imposed treaty-like agreements or covenants on entire populations. Scholars actually call them loyalty oaths. These documents generally treat issues that are important to kings. Thus, we read in the Hittite treaties, for example, about the loyalty to the king, the establishment of frontiers, and military cooperation, among other things. So loyalty to the crown prince, loyalty to the crown king, was the protection of royal succession. And that's what dominated the success of most of those treaties. It was to protect the king. In this treaty that God makes, it's about protecting his promise to humanity. He's making it not to protect himself, but to protect us. totally setting himself apart from them, totally bringing himself forward, showing the level of his love, of his compassion, of his mercy, that if you don't know this about these covenants, you miss. The Hittite treaties usually begin with a historical introduction and contain a list of both blessings for obedience and cursings for disobedience. The Neo-Assyrian treaties do not have the historical introduction. They contain no list of blessings, but have an especially lengthy curse section for violating the treaty. Treaties, and here's what's interesting. These treaties were invoked to be witnessed by their gods. So when they're passing through these pieces, as Hittites, as these Neo-Assyrians, that when they're passing through, they're these kings that are saying, they're basically saying, let our gods judge us. May the curses of my gods come upon you. That's what they're saying as they're walking among these pieces, reciting this lengthy list of curses. Are you getting a better glimpse of your father? They would invoke their gods to bear witnesses to the stipulations and the oaths that the parties took, and they were commanded to abide by them. The physical documents were then usually deposited in a temple, oftentimes in an ark, where they served as reminders to the gods that they worshiped to enforce this treaty, to enforce this covenant. The Hittite documents also required the vassal to read its text yearly as a reminder of its requirements. So if you know anything about the law, some of these things should already be standing out in your mind from Deuteronomy, Exodus, Leviticus. But we'll go over more of that. And so we see God standing out as different, being the one God of Israel, which this is why it's so important to the Hebrew people. That's why the beginning of every Shema, at the beginning of so many prayers, that the first thing that you hear them say, why every day they're to rise and before they go to bed, they are to say, hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one. Because it was different in Israel. They were the only ones who worshiped one God at this time. It's what set them apart. It's what made them different. And Abram was the first one to begin to share this idea of this one true God. To live a life with this one true God. When he encounters his enemies, they talk about, we've heard about your God, not your gods, your God. So there was a testimony that this Abram and his people, his mighty army and all that he did, served one God and not the many gods. So it's a testimony. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one. Monotheism was unheard of in this region. And so we see God bringing humanity out of their darkened understanding. We see him bringing us in, out of what is normal for that time in that season. We see God making this treaty or this covenant with Abram on behalf of all humanity. And it isn't for his good, for his praise, or his power, like it was in those, with those other gods. It is 100% him giving himself to do. 100% him giving himself for us. 100% him giving the pledge, the oath, between himself. As Abram is asleep. We also see a prophetic picture of a few things in this. There's also a covenantal promise, not just of the land, the seed, the nation. But there's also, if you remember at the end, before God walks through, he tells him, this will all be yours, but your descendants will be imprisoned for 400 years. Your people will dwell in another land, but I will deliver them, but it will be 400 years. The fourth generation, they will return. But somewhere I've read 400 years, so forgive me, erase that as fact. But then in the fourth generation, they will return here, for the iniquity of the Amorite is not yet complete. So we see this covenantal promise of the land. We see it of the seed and of the nation. But we also here are told Abraham, God tells Abraham about his people being held captive. And if you remember, we have a smoking furnace and a lit torch. When Israel leaves Egypt, they are led by a cloud by day and fire by night. When they escape Egypt, they have to pass through the Red Sea to be baptized into him. And so we see God showing the passing through of symbolic Red Sea as all of this blood is there from these animals being slaughtered. So it's a prophetic picture also of his promise to lead them out, that he will pass them through the Red Sea and they will be led by fire and they will be led by smoke as they follow him from the place of captivity into the place of promise. Is it 13? Okay, I had it written down, but I couldn't find it. But thank you. Yes, it is in verse 13. Oppressed for 400 years. Thank you. So don't miss this. This is how absolutely thorough God is in his plan. I love it. So a cloud by day, smoking furnace. Fire by night, the flaming torch. He leads Israel from Egypt into their place of promise, passing through the dissected parts of the ram and the heifer, reminding them of the river of blood, a prophetic picture of when they will pass through the Red Sea and be baptized as the people of God. It's an amazing thing that we see here. In chapter 16, we pass through, and now we see Sarah. Sarah decides she's going to make it happen. Chapter 16, Sarah gives up on herself and decides that her slave girl is the answer to all their problems. And I'm not going to read all of this, but most of you here and many who may watch this know the story. If not, you can go and read 16. But basically, Sarah decides that she's going to give Abram, her slave girl, because she's barren. She's been bearing all this time. She's an old woman. And so she gives him Hagar, her slave girl. And then Abram lays with her. She conceives. She has the baby Ishmael. And from there on, there is all kinds of problems. It even comes to the point where Sarai throws Hagar and the son out into the desert. But God's so faithful to Abram that he shows up on Hagar's account and brings her back into his covering. So Hagar bore Abram a son, and Abram called the name of his son, whom Hagar bore, Ishmael. And Abraham was 86 years old when Hagar bore Ishmael to him. Now, chapter 17, and there's so much good stuff in this, but it's not conducive to the covenant study. So maybe someday we'll just do the whole Abraham story from beginning to end. Chapter 17 begins another transition for us with this covenant. Because if we read this now, when Abraham was 99, so the baby was born at 86, this story picks up how many years later? 12? 86? 13 years later. Because now Abram is 99 years old. And the Lord appeared to Abram and said to him, I am God Almighty, or El Shaddai. Walk before me and be blameless. That word blameless there means mature, rounded out, grown up. 2, I will establish my covenant between me and you, and I will multiply you exceedingly. And Abraham fell on his face, and God talked with him, saying, as for me, behold, my covenant is with you, and you will be the father of a multitude of nations. No longer shall your name be called Abram, but your name shall be Abraham. And I will make you the father of a multitude of nations. Verse 6, and I will make you exceedingly fruitful, and I will make you nations of you, and the kings will come forth from you. I will establish my covenant between me and you and your descendants after you throughout their generations, for an everlasting covenant to be God to you and to your descendants after you. I will give to you and to your descendants after you the land of your sojourning, all the land of Canaan, for everlasting possession, and I will be their God. And God said further to Abraham, now, as for you, you shall keep my covenant, you and your descendants after you, throughout their generations. This is my covenant which you shall keep between me and you and your descendants. Notice I keep saying between, because this word is not found in Genesis 12 and it's not found in Genesis 15. Let's wonder why. So we keep going through here. This is my covenant which you shall keep between me and you and your descendants after you. Every male among you shall be circumcised, and you shall be circumcised in the flesh of your foreskin, and it shall be the sign of the covenant between me and you. And every male among you who is 8 days old shall be circumcised through your generation. A servant who is born in the house or who is bought with money from any foreigner who is not of your descendants, a servant who is born in your house or who is bought with your money shall surely be circumcised. Thus shall my covenant be in your flesh for an everlasting covenant. But an uncircumcised male who is not circumcised in the flesh of his foreskin, that person shall be cut off from his people, for he has broken my covenant. And then he says, God said to Abraham, as for Sarai, your wife, you shall not call her Sarai, but Sarah shall be her name. And I will bless her indeed. I will give you a son by her. Then I will bless her, and she shall be a mother of nations. King of peoples will come from her. Then Abraham fell on his face and laughed and said in his heart, will a child be born of a man 100 years old? And will Sarah, who is 90 years old, bear a child? And Abram said to God, oh, that Ishmael might live before you. But God said, no, but Sarah, your wife, will bear you a son, and you shall call his name Isaac, and I will establish my covenant with him for an everlasting covenant for his descendants after him. As for Ishmael, I have heard you. Behold, I will bless him, and I will make him fruitful, and I will multiply him exceedingly. He shall become the father of 12 princes, and I will make him a great nation. But my covenant I will establish with Isaac, whom Sarah will bear to you at this season next year. When he finished talking with him, God went up from Abraham. Then Abraham took Ishmael, his sons, and all of his servants, and he circumcised them all, and it goes on from there. So something shifts. So here we have God, with all of his grace, reaching through darkness into the pagan culture, pulling Abram out to himself, choosing him. By a voice, Abram follows him. God makes him promises that you'll be a father. In Genesis chapter 15, again, God reaffirms his covenant promise with him by making this promise to him for himself, that God makes the pledge that anything that happens with this covenant is on me. It's on me to do. I will do it. Genesis 16, Sarah decides she needs to make this oath come forth. Sarah chooses to do it in her own strength, through her own understanding. Sarah, again, wanting what she wanted, decides that she knows better than God and begins to do things her own way. So now we see God again affirming his covenant. But obviously, there was still a level of unbelief. So now the covenant is made in their flesh. So now the sign of that covenant is put in the foreskin of every male. So they carry the mark of that promise that God freely offered, that God freely gave. But because we had to get at that tree of the knowledge of good and evil, that do it on my own, that I can handle this. I know I want to be like God and make all these decisions and take his place. Sound like a pattern has been repeated before? And so now it's like the covenant that I was giving you, this grant that I was making to you, this beautiful thing now that you didn't have any requirement for except to believe, now let's put a mark in the flesh to remind you. And so Sarah You'll see that mark too. When you're intimate with your husband, you'll know that mark. To remind them of what God had promised. So it wasn't that the covenant standards changed, but God realized he had to make a deeper mark, so to speak, on this promise. And now they carried it, not only the promise in their, so they went from the promise in their heart to the promise in their flesh to remind them. It's actually a step down to what God offered. And so, of course, we see that after this, we know that Sarah does indeed get pregnant. We know that she does indeed bear the son, Isaac. We know that she does indeed bring forth this child at 90 years of age, 91, I guess, because he said in this season. And Abraham indeed brings forth a son. Out of their barrenness comes fruitfulness. Out of this place of barrenness, God brings forth the son of promise that has within his loins the seed of promise that will come forth through Jesus. Genesis 17, 1 to 3. I am a mighty God, he said. I am the Almighty One. I am El Shaddai. Interesting that he introduces himself as El Shaddai, right? Which one of the names for El Shaddai is Many-Breasted One. So he chooses to reveal himself as the Many-Breasted One to Abram and to Sarah as they're talking about paternity and maternity and the coming forth of children. I don't think it was an accident. He's revealing to them who he is. I'm showing you another part of me. I'm telling you, I am El Shaddai. I am the one who, what is, I forgot what else El Shaddai is. I always say, many-breasted one. Oh my goodness, Jesus help me. All right, it'll probably come back to me as I talk. So here Abram and Sarah, after taking the promise into their own hands, God now again reaffirms the covenant, but this time instead of just the promise, there's a mark that must be left in the flesh, a sign that they'd be carried around to trust that he would carry it out. And then it serves as a sign to all those now of this promise of redemption of all humanity, all the way back to Genesis chapter 3. Over and over again, Genesis 12, Genesis 15, God says, I will, I will, I will. It's interesting to note that the word covenant is only used, is not used at all in Genesis 12. The actual word covenant is not used in Genesis 12. It's a promise, it's an oath that's made. In Genesis 15, it's only used one time. One time in Genesis chapter 15 and dealing with Abram's, after Abram's unbelief, he's like saying to him, remember, it's not, he's trying to pull him past his unbelief. And so God says, go and get me the heifers, lay them out, do as I say. God passes through. He makes the promise himself. He agrees to take it upon himself to see it accomplished, to live and die for this oath to come about. And then it says, and so this is the covenant I made with you. He doesn't say between us. But the word covenant is used 14 times in chapter 17. Here we also see that their names are changed. Why? Now because they must come into alignment with the promise. They must come into alignment with who they are to be, who they are to come. God confirms the promise that they are indeed who God said they will be, because Abram was exalted father. But now he is to be father of many nations, Abraham. And then we have Sarai, who is princess, but then she becomes Sarah, who is princess of many. And so the Ha is this picture. It's like a prophetic picture of Yahweh. And so when God comes in and we allow him to be planted, there is multiplication. And so he goes from being an exalted father to a father of many. Sarah becomes just not the personal princess of Abram, but she becomes the princess of many. And so we see this covenant that God makes with them. play out throughout the course of history. And we begin that story here in Genesis 12 and go all the way through to 50. That's the canon around that. And then it begins to speak to other covenants and begins to reveal Jesus even more. Well, many of you, again, because part of what I believe God is doing in these texts, in Genesis especially, is revealing God, bringing him out of the darkened understanding of humanity into the glorious light, that he would be seen as he really is. And one of those things is contingent. My argument is contingent on the fact of how God defies the way other gods act in that region, the way the gods that they knew behaved and what they demanded and what they wanted and how they worshiped them. And so even though this story is not necessarily included in the covenant part, but it does speak to faith. But you remember part of the story of Abraham and Isaac is that they ascend to the mountain. God says to take them up and sacrifice his son. He tells Abram to take him. So Abraham does exactly as God tells him. He takes him to the top. He's preparing the altar. He's preparing the place of sacrifice. And then he is like, Isaac asks him, he says, Father, where's the sacrifice? And he says, God will provide. And so Isaac and Abraham are journeying up. They set up the altar. I've already said that. But then they get him on. And just as Abraham is about to bring the knife down on his beloved son, an angel of the Lord shows up and says, stop, for God knows that you will keep your promise. We see that all the time, as though the faith is that even if God took, this is some of the things I've heard preached, that even if Isaac died, Abraham believed God would just give him another son. And others believe that he would have raised him from the dead as a prophetic picture of Jesus. And what I'm trying to get us to understand, God bringing us out of the darkened understanding, is that in that day, at that time, it was not unusual for those gods, those idols that were worshipped by the Hittites and the Perizzites and the Jebusites and all those ites, the Neo-Assyrians and all of them in that region, for the eldest son to have been sacrificed. So when God asked Abraham to do that, that would have been part of how he understood God as a pagan worshiper. So to ask him to do that, it was really just obeying what he knew. What changed is that this God jumps in and says, no, don't take that. I'm not taking your son. I'm offering you a sacrifice, which is a prophetic picture that our God does not demand the blood of our sons. This God is so amazing. He gives us the blood of his. Totally different than those gods of that day. And so we have this prophetic picture of the ram that is caught in the bush. That is the prophetic picture of the sacrifice that will be given for us, that God provides, not Abraham. It's not our children that are demanded. It's not demanding that we go out and gather goats and rams and all of those things. God will provide a sacrifice just as he showed us back when he passed through those pieces and said, I will be the one to make this promise happen. I am willing to lay my own life down, basically saying, I am willing to die to make this promise happen. It's mirrored again. It's echoed again in this moment with Isaac and Abraham and the altar at the top of the mountain, where God promises, I will be the one to do it. And we'll learn how Jesus fulfills this covenant completely. But this is the way we must see this journey of God with humanity. This is the vision that we must see, that God has taken from the very beginning to prove that God's not angry. He's not looking to destroy humanity. He's not looking to destroy this earth. That his entire plan from the beginning is to bring humanity back to who God created them to be, back in his image, back in his likeness, that we would be formed as a people who understood and were reconnected and were a part of him. So that's why it's so important that we lay these foundations, because there are things we have not heard. These are things that we have not been taught. These are things that are not in the foundation of our understanding of God. And our faulty understanding of some of these covenants is what's brought a faulty understanding of who God is. And it causes us to project a God made in our image instead of us reflecting the image of the God whose image we are made in. So, Father, we just ask that you will cause us to see deeper, cause us to see things from a higher place, cause us to experience you in deeper realms, to tear down any false images that we have created of you, to pluck up any false doctrine or teaching that keeps us planted in a place of fear, planted in a place of judgment, planted in a place of just total misunderstanding of who you are. Uproot any things, Lord, that have lodged themselves in the place of growth, that have lodged themselves in a way that ceases or causes us to not press into the fullness of who you are. Let us be reminded that the covenant that we are in is a covenant that you made with yourself for us. That you set yourself among those pieces, among the broken pieces of those animals, representing the brokenness of humanity, the brokenness of our own lives, of the ways that we had separated ourselves from you. That you passed yourself through those, promising that I will do everything that is needed. I will give of myself. I am willing to die, and I make this oath and this pledge to see all things restored to myself through a seed, Abram, that will come through you. Let us be reminded that that has always been your intention, that has always been your heart, it has always been your plan. And Father, let us embrace and fully grow up into it and into its mission. We ask these things in Jesus' precious name. Amen.